here in luxury with an entire staff helping me. And, if they would only know the Atmos Nefesh on every little turn.
You have a practice for it, that's it.
I'm allowed into Machon Lev, but I don't have a reserve parking. But they're mechabed me because they I got this building. Imagine what it would be for them if this would Davy Yellens. All right, let's begin. We have a guest here today. He traveled a long way to get here. Daniel Silverman. I stayed in his parents' house when I was in South Africa. 2002, so make the cheshbon about 17 years ago. First of all, let's give the date. Today is October 7th, 2019. We are Erev Yom Kippur, Yom Hadin, and all that goes with it. In relation to a question that Jack asked me, I have a very interesting story. Jack told me that many years ago I mentioned that one time we were davening with the Rav and davening Mincha, and you could hear him saying the Shmon Esrei, and at first I thought maybe it's a Hecha Kedusha. Then I realized, no, he's saying it so he could hear with his ears. About 2 months ago, 3 months ago, before the summer, in the shul I daven Mincha, a whole Rifka, where I generally daven, otherwise once in a while Yatama. So some guy told me off that I'm making noise during the silent Shmon Esrei. Then in the summer, I was in this apartment in Lander College, and there was a nice library there, and I picked up a sefer, I think it was Tisha B'Av. I wanted something to do. This was not really learning, it was stories about the Briska Rav. So I take a look in the sefer. There's the same story with the Briska Rav that he davened. You could hear him davening. And Talmidim went over to the Briska Rav and asked him, Chana, you don't hear her voice? And the Briska Rav answered, yes, you daven low, but you have to daven loud enough for your ears to hear. So evidently this is a shita from Brisk. And that will explain it. It also explains another story to me, that in the 70s, the Talmidim of the Rav was shaking because they heard the Rav say, Sim Shalom at Mincha. So after davening, Talmidim, this is what I was told. Remember, I'm far from America already by the 70s. And they went over to him and asked him, Rebbe, how do you say Priska and Ashkenaz, Alitvat? They spoke English to him, they didn't know Yiddish. I said, Vikum Tzarich, Zagim Sim Shalom. And he said, what's the question? I grew up in Chaslavich in Chabad. Shalom Rav, Nusachari. All right, I can't verify the story.
Sim Shalom.
He said Nusachari, I grew up.
Which is Sim Shalom.
Sim Shalom, right. And at Mincha. But that also indicates that the Rav was saying it loud enough to be heard. Yes. Yesterday in class, I was looking for this. I had it in the closet. And I have another copy. I have two copies in front of me. But I told an inspiring story for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, we're living in Israel. I cannot say it's the most inspiring period, what we've gone through with the election for the Iriyah. Remember all the hatred between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim. It's sickening, sickening. And then this election, the hatred against Torah, Rakefet let off steam in Beit Shemesh. Not bad, last Thursday night. We're dealing here with people who only understand democracy. They're not bad people. These are not the Apikosim of old. These are the Apikosim of new. The Apikosim of old were hated religion, were mad at religion. They were raised religiously. They blamed every fault in the world on the rabbis. That was Ben-Gurion. That was Chaim Weizmann. That was a different generation. Today's generation, they are such Amei Haaretz, as Golda Meir said. We wanted to raise a generation of Apikosim, and all we raised was a generation of Amei Haaretz. And she said that 50 years ago. I heard that with my own two ears when I came in Aliyah, one of her famous public talks. Today, they're Amei Haaretz to the 10th power, the 20th power. It's beyond comprehension. I just let off steam about Beit Shemesh and you're not here. I can't win. So they believe in democracy. This is a democratic state. I also believe in democracy, but Judaism comes first. It's a Jewish democratic state. And our friend Smutridge, who could use a seasoned American rabbi standing next to him, didn't help the situation, a halachic state. That's all they had to hear. You created a target for all the bullets. We're a Jewish state. Halacha, don't worry about it. Halacha depends on individuals. If 10% observe, 20, 30, 40, 50, one day we'll hit 99%. It'll be a halachic state, but a Jewish state. And with all going on, so this news made me very happy. I saw this, they don't show the picture of the poster. I saw it on one of the websites, or I saw it in one of the newspapers. But the story is, in this yeshiva, Tzomet Poria, B'pniyat La'avur La'eva Moshav Hazarim. Does anyone know where that is? Where is it? Tell us. On the way to the ferry. That's right, Poria. Hevanti. Tzomet Poria, B'pniyat La'eva Moshav Hazarim. Anyway, so these kids felt very bad. The Rebbeim, everyone is so depressed. Here it is called the Shalom, getting ready for Rosh Hashanah, and all you hear is hatred and enmity for Torah, and you look at the posters that are up, so unknown to the Rosh Yeshiva, the kids chipped in, and they put up a poster right on the highway. The Yeshiva Torat Hazarim, that's the name of the yeshiva, Matkilim Shanayim Yitziyat HaShabbat, Masechet Shabbat, Perek Rishon, Mitachet lekoteret tzuraf pasuk pafon meir einayim ki hem chayenu ve'orach yameinu letzad tmunat talmidei hayeshiva hashoktim al talmudam v'tzilum hadaf harishon shel mesechet Shabbat. To me, this was so inspiring. It gave me strength. I have a simple question to ask. Is there anyone here, Dov, where is your smicha that you got from Yeshivas Rabbein Yitzchak Elchanan?
Where is it? It's on my wall.
It's on your wall. Can you photograph it for me and give it to me next time we meet? Are you organized? We're not going to meet again until after Sukkot.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason is, for I don't even know where my smicha is, someplace in a closet under a pile with it. Funny shalom. But exactly, later in life it becomes...
No, what do you need now?
Because they sent me a copy. Remember, I dedicated the shiur yesterday to Rav Shlomo Maimon, who just died, 102 years of age, probably the last living Talmud who yet studied with Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So they say his smicha is unique because it says, Hey, hey, harav hagodol. I don't think that's unique. I think every smicha, that's why I told you, the YU smicha is worthless. Everyone gets the same smicha. If you're a gon, if you're a tzaddik, if you're an idiot, an oislap, a trumpenik, a pushtat. Hey, you know what hey means? Idiot hagadol, whatever you want it to mean. Harav hagadol, ha'ish hagadol. It has no meaning. It's the biggest farce ever. And the ketubi, you're right. Hey. Okay? But Harav HaGadol, I think, is standard form. That's what I want to check. So I appreciate, okay? So I just want to mention that my Talmud Yossi Azoz, who's listening, will check it out and we'll see whether your comment is correct or not. Mike Schatz wrote to me, and I think this is very correct. I made the point that America of the 1920s was, on one hand, was the great melting pot. The concept of ethnic multiplicity didn't exist yet, or wasn't stressed. And therefore, the conservative movement triumphed because that was mamish America in the full sense of the word. So my Talmud sent me a picture of his mother's passport, or his grandmother's passport. It's from... it's his grandmother, 1925, and in back of the passport, it says in many languages that this is a past Buddha. One of the languages is Yiddish. So he wants to show me there was some ethnicity even then. But it doesn't contradict what I said. There's a big difference between coming into the airport in South Florida, coming into Miami Beach, or coming into Los Angeles, and you can't believe your ears. The announcements are all made. Spanish, English, it follows the Spanish. You go into a bank today. I went into two different banks in New York, one time in Washington Heights, and one time in Kew Gardens Hills, corner of Leicester. And the teller speaks to me in Spanish. It takes one look at me and perfect Spanish. So today it's a little bit different. There's ethnic multiplicity in the full sense of the word. He makes another point, which is very well taken. We've mentioned many, many times that the Talmud Torah did not really succeed. It never turned out kids that were from to find a kid who went, you know what a Talmud, Danny, you're in a world here of Anglos, so you got a problem. But in the 1900 through 1970, most kids who got a Jewish education in America went to Talmud Torah three times a week after public school. So he mentioned turning out from kids one out of a thousand. So he mentions that he went to a Talmud Torah high school. And this was in White Plains, a number of synagogues combined, conservative, orthodox. It was housed in a large conservative temple. Rav Avram Kahana, a customer of Meir Kahana, was the principal. And it was a serious operation. And there, many of the kids did turn out B'nai Torah. But there's one big difference. To go to Talmud Torah until Bar Mitzvah, your parents forced you to. The shul forced you to. To go to high school Talmud Torah, you had to decide on your own. You made a decision. So it showed already there was interest, commitment. And Ein Hachinami, many of these kids, Baruch Hashem, are living Alat Matakodesh today. All right, now I want to go further. I want to finish up Rabbi Lichtenstein. And Danny, just to briefly explain to you, this class began in 1978. It's nothing to do with the Sunday class, which is Shas Paiskim, although what we're coming into is the whole Sunday class is a direct introduction to what we're coming to perhaps later today, but not at this moment. So in this class, I can whatever I want, I have the right to teach. I'm teaching myself. So about 7 years ago, we began the history of Torah in the Western world, in the Western continent, the United States, and the Kainer also is the Anachschlepper. It's a little satellite around the great United States, the great New York. So we're dealing here with the three most famous Orthodox rabbis who put Orthodoxy on the map in the synagogues. We're talking 100 years ago. And we've been dealing with rabbis, perhaps you've heard some of the names, rabbis Leo Young, Herbert S. Goldstein, and we're finishing up Joe Lichtenstein. Now with Joe Lichtenstein, I want to come back to something I said about the Rav, because I saw from some of the correspondence around the world, people didn't understand me clearly. The Rav was a very fascinating individual. A volume just appeared by a guy named Rakefet, and that volume has two pages that a lot of people are talking about. What are the two pages? It's actually three pages. There's one picture of the Rav teaching, which became the quintessential picture of the Rav teaching. You know, many pictures are taken, but this picture, the photographer was 60 years ago. The photographer stood in one, it was a double classroom that the Rav taught in my time, and he got 29 students. There might have been 40 students in the room, but he got 29. And whenever they have to publish a picture of the Rav teaching, this is the picture that's published. I published it twice, I believe. I published it in my work on the Rav, and I published it in Washington. So this picture always beguiled me. Who are these 29 students? And it took me 5 years, and I was able to identify 29 out of 29. Now, it's quite an achievement because one student, all you see is his hand. But that was easy for me because I knew who it was. He sat opposite me. I was sitting here. The Rav is here, and Aaron Lichtenstein is here. So even though all you see is part of his hand, I knew it had to be Reb Aaron. One of them was very hard. The Rav's hand blocks the face. That was the hardest one. My wife gets the credit. I had 28 out of 29. A year ago, I had 27 out of 29. Now I had 28. And she said he's wearing a bow tie. And I went into my college yearbook, my Smith 59, and sure enough, Izzy Wind is always with. Then I remembered that's where Izzy Wind sat. And as I told you, I believe in Beit Shemesh, it's very frightening, but Izzy Wind came to visit me from the other world and thanked me. It was real. He says to me, Arnie, thank you for bringing me back to the world of the living. End quote. Fine. Now, what's amazing about the picture is those 29 people, you have all the future leaders of right-wing YU, centrist YU, left-wing YU, sitting right before the Rav, like Yinglach, B'dechilu Urechimu. And I can give you names, it's very simple. Here, Mark is sitting here. Abba Brandspiegel, Rabbi Brandspiegel, that's his Rebbe, all right? He left YU in anger. I can testify. I mean, we grew up together. We were friendly all for decades, friendly generations. And he left YU in anger. It's a bet of apikursim. And he was the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Lander College. All right? There, you don't have to go further. There are other right-wingers there, but that's a classic example. Sitting there is Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. Well, if he isn't a centrist, I don't know who is. Right or wrong, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, PhD from Harvard. What did you learn in Harvard? Harvard said, I learned that life was very complex. And the yeshiva, you know, when we teach, we have a habit like the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. You follow me? Kizeh Re'eh V'Kadesh. And a good Rebbe has to mention to students that life is complex. But all right, we'll leave that for another lecture. So there you have Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. There you have Saul Berman. Saul Berman is the godfather of what evolves into Chovevei Torah, right or wrong. Saul Berman, Eidar, I have a tape of him in the 70s. I couldn't believe my ears. And they're all sitting in front of the Rav. So now the question is, who was the Rav? So I have to tell you, here's where the Rav was very different than everyone else. Remember, you're looking at someone who was just honored, acknowledged by Lakewood this past summer. I learned in Lakewood. I knew Reb Aaron intimately. I was a chutzpah de kid, but I had a good mind as a kid. With Reb Aaron, if you know the Litva Shoresh Yeshivavik, you can be as chutzpahdik as you want. Am I right or wrong? If the mind is good, if you're trying to learn and you can, you know, enhance the Rosh Yeshiva's knowledge, the Gemara and Tainus, Daf Zayin, they'll tolerate the chutzpah. I knew Reb Aaron. I spoke in learning with Reb Moshe. Well, you see, Reb Aaron cast a certain hashkafah. Reb Moshe cast a certain hashkafah. He was a little more flexible than Reb Aaron. The Rav, there was a total flexibility. By that I mean it's like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Can you pinpoint the Lubavitcher Rebbe? I had a student in Michala, which was bright girl and dead set on going to Chevron and settling in Yehuda V'Shomron. And she wrote to the Rebbe what to do. She was absolutely a Bala Tshuva. I taught many Hasidim of Chabad. I would imagine most of those that I taught in the schools that I taught were Bala Tshuva. She wrote a letter to the Rebbe what to do. She showed me the answer. I quote it to you. Beit Yaakov Kadima. I thought to myself, this girl is as much matimah for Beit Yaakov Seminary like I am for Mapes Yildung's judicial course. You understand? But she went. The Rebbe told her. She went. All right, that's the Rebbe. Someone else will come to the Rebbe, a lady with a PhD from Harvard University. The Rebbe will discuss with her chemistry and biology what her PhD is in. In a million years, he's not going to tell her, go to Beis Yaakov Seminary. He's going to not only accept her for what she is, but encourage Shud to go further. In the endless examples, there were people who grew up in communities far from Yiddishkeit they came from. The Rebbe would tell them, go back to where you came from and influence others. See, he dealt with everyone on his individual basis. I believe that was the Rav. I have to share it with you. And this is why the Rav can have so many different Talmidim. The Rav was multifaceted. If you recall, I ended off the class last week with the Rav talking at the dinner. Kehillat Jeshurun is, the building is 70 years old, 75 years old. Right or wrong, they're celebrating this big celebration. And the Rav heaps so much praise on Rabbi Luchstein and on Ramaz. You know what Ramaz, the school Rabbi Luchstein founded. Ramaz, if you don't know, go to Harafa, go on Google, because even in South Africa, they should know about Ramaz. R-A-M-A-Z. Z you say, or Z?
Z.
Z, okay. I've lived here over 50 years. I also say Z. I've been ruined. So you see, the Rav, he really meant that praise. But what the Rav was really saying was, for the Upper East Side, you needed Ramaz. For Brookline, circa 1937, that era, you needed Maimonides. I don't believe, let's take another picture of the Rav. How many of you were ever at a Yahrzeit Shir? Dov, in your time, Yahrzeit Shir, Vic, in the 50s, the 60s? Morty, Charlie, a Yahrzeit Shir. In my time, 1,700 people. Afterwards, it was 3,000-4,000. They had, a hookup in the Beis Medrash, a hookup across the street. But in my time, the Lamport Auditorium was filled, and here was the Rav, and you're going for 4.5 hours. There was nothing like him in modern Torah history on that level. It's not like the Rebbe. The Rebbe could go 10 hours, but it was broken up with a l'chaim, with singing. There was a talk on one level, a talk on another level, a talk of chassidus. Here is the Rav with Shas and Paiskim on the highest litvish level, Reb Chaim coming to life, his grandson. In walks Reb Chaim Hella. And you saw covered Hatera, the Rav stopped speaking, walked down from the podium, greeted Reb Chaim, took him by hand, took his coat, his hat, placed it in back on a chair, took him up to the podium where Gedolei Rosh Yeshiva was sitting, sat Reb Chaim down, and only then did he continue the shiur. Now, could you picture in the middle of the shiur, the Rav would interrupt and say, Morai v'rabosai, midafshikin al kindet Ramaz. You want to send, we have to send all our children to Ramaz. You understand? That wasn't right then. You would ask the Rav, that audience, these people, it was a different ballpark. He understood there are different homes, different communities, different environments, and each one has to find its level of Torah. That was the Rav. And I can bring you a simple proof to it. I'll tell you two stories. One story that I publicized that everyone... And by the way, this story has been quoted in quite a few places. I take a look. It's been quoted... by the way, he quotes me correctly with the Cleves Get, the book you lent me. My wife says indefatigable. I didn't know you're indefatigable. I'm my age. I'm not indefatigable, but thank him for the compliment. A book just came out that Vic lent me, and some of my scholarship is quoted, and he writes that he couldn't believe, you have to look at it, I don't want to take me too much time to explain it, but he couldn't believe what I wrote, and he checked it out in Reb Moshe, and he says, Rav Rakefet, absolutely right. There he goes. It's very cute what he does. Anyway, the Rav, there was Chaim Gold. Anyone recognize the name? Rabbi Chaim Gold. It was Rav Zev Gold's grandson, Rav Moshe Gold's son. His father studied in Hebron. His life was saved by miracles in the massacre, 1929. So Chaim Gold studied in Israel, was a kid, sent to Israel at a young age, and then his father died young. His father was the first rabbi in Englewood, New Jersey. Englewood, New Jersey, today you can't walk Dalet Amot without bumping into Frum people. At that time, there was barely a minion of Shomrei Shabbos people. It was the first rabbi, Moshe Gold. So when Moshe died, his widow wanted Chaim back. And they brought him back from Israel. He came to Yeshiva University. And I was very friendly with him. To me, a kid who lived in Israel, I was overwhelmed. A kid who actually lived in Israel. We became very good friends. And now we're in college together, and he was a year younger than I am. And today, if you look at him, you would think he's 25 years older than I am. A long white beard, and they gave Mr. Bekesher, and Baruch Hashem. He looks like a saint out of 200 years ago. Kol HaKavod, Kew Gardens Hills. So I have a Talmud who's his next door neighbor, so I see him every summer. So the next year, second year, when we're in the Rav Shir, Chaim, after we finish Shir at 3 o'clock, he goes into the Beis Medrash. And I say, Chaim, aren't you going to college? No, it's not important. I got to learn. I couldn't believe my ears. So I was a wise Alec Yenter of a kid. So I went to the Rav. And I said, Rebbe, after Shir, Rav's sitting here, I'm standing. Rebbe, do you know that Chaim is not going to college? The Rav, what? Bring him to me immediately. So I went into the Beis Medrash, and I brought Chaim in. It's an absolute, every syllable true. And it's not art scroll now, it's absolutely true, every nuance. And the Rav says to Chaim, Chaim, what's this that Arnold tells me you're not going to college? And there's Chaim, he's starting to shake. So Chaim, let me tell you. I don't know Pshat and Pirkei Avot when it says Torah im Derech Eretz. He says, I don't know Pshat. But one thing I know, Bizman Hazeh, Derech Eretz means college. There's no pupil about it. Yofe Talmud Torim Deretz Kel Sheshkiat Shneim Mishkachat Ofon. Quoted the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. And Chaim says, but the Rebbe, no. He says, what? And the Rav quoted the Gemara in Baba Batra. I give you the source in Washington, that Beit Din is Avin Shel Yitomim. And he says to him, you're a Yotam, I'm part of the Beit Din, I'm responsible for you. You go up to college. So Chaim then says, Rebbe, it's too late to register. No, you go upstairs and go register. Chaim, now it's three flights up. If you know Yeshiva University, you're with one building, the lower floor is the high school, the all the way up is the college. Chaim says, so the Murray Rebbe says to me, Arnold, who do I have to speak to? I say, Professor Silverman. Come with me. So we go into Rabbi Belkin's office. Helen Atlas was Rabbi Belkin's secretary, his right hand. And I say to her, Rabbi Soloveitchik needs Professor Silverman. Of course. She sits down, she dials the number, gives the phone to the Rav, and the Rav says, Professor Silverman, this is Yosef Soloveitchik speaking. A student will come to you to register, please. Give him everything he needs. I will be very appreciative. And then about an hour later, Chaim comes down, comes into the Beis Medrash, and he says to me, Ani, you won't believe it. No late fees. Everything I wanted. And when Professor Silverman finished, he said to me, be sure to tell Rabbi Soloveitchik that I took care of everything. He said, what did he mean by that? I said, it's better you shouldn't know. But anyway, what do you see from that story? You see, that's the Rav. You want to learn, fine. But Bizman Hazeh, Torum Derech Eretz, and Derech Eretz means college. But now I'll tell you a story that's slightly opposite. I'm at an RCA convention. This is 77. I was sent by the State of Israel to address Rabbinical Council of America, RCA. So Rebbe embraced me. We'll leave that part of it for another time. And I'm standing next to Rebbe, and there was a rub from Chicago, Rabbi Lairfield, and he had a number of very good sons, Talmidei Chachamim. One of them was learning in Lakewood, and he didn't go to college. He later goes on to South Florida, he in the North Miami Beach, if you know, he's Masada Gittin, a fine Talmud Chacham. And the Rav starts talking with him and learning. And then the Rav turns to his father, and he says, "Mit ayazunas afaginigin seret mit them in lernen." Again, with your son, it's a pleasure to speak in learning. He knows. So you notice, the Rav didn't say one word. Your son, a lamdan, how come he didn't go to college? How come he doesn't have a degree? How come he doesn't have a profession? How come he's not capable and competent of dealing with the Western world? And with Balabatim, who all have masters by that time, many doctorates, etc., etc. But you see, the Rav was like, in my understanding of the Rav, he was like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He understood there's a very wide spectrum there. And he dealt with each one within context. It was not like the yeshiva world today, where everyone dresses the same, looks the same, acts the same. That was not the Rav. Neither was that the Rebbe, but it certainly was not the Rav. And this is how I understand his comments. It's not that the Rav is going to tell you or you, send your kids only to Ramaz. But if you live on the Upper East Side and you're part of that crowd, and your income yearly is in the seven figures, talking the Upper East Side now, Ramaz, what Rabbi Lookstein accomplished? Fabulous. Prestige to Judaism that even wealthy, successful people don't have to go to Reform and Conservative temples to find the Judaism that unites and synthesizes with the Upper East Side. And that's how I understand the Rav, and I just want to make myself clear, it's not that the Rav advocated every kid in the world has to go to Ramaz. Okay. I hope I'm clear. I hope I'm right. People can debate endlessly who the Rav was. And the greatest proof that I might is the Rav's own family. Look what came out of him. Tell me, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of the biggest Tzedi Yeshiva in the state of Israel today? The Rav's grandson, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. No? Who's the Rosh Yeshiva of the second oldest yeshiva in the United States that just celebrated 100 years? Teira Vadas? No? Rabbi Yitzchak Lichtenstein. Itzi Lichtenstein. The Rav's grandson. Remember what I said, and that I say to him in Beit Shemesh? That Teira Vadas had gedacht umgekommen to Yeshiva University to find the Rosh Yeshiva today. They had to come to YU to get a Rosh Yeshiva. Unbelievable. No? Look at the Rav's the Rav's nephew, Rav Moshe Meiselman. Look at his hashkafas. Look at the Rav's cousin, Rabbi Shurkin. What, you're not going to say he's a good Talmud of the Rav? His Harare Kedem, Sfarim are fabulous. Look at the Rav's grandson, Reb Meir Twesky. Look at the Rav's late grandson, HaKadosh, Reb Moshe Twesky, Hashem Yikom Damo. Who was the Rav? It's a good question. And I want to tell you something. You cannot judge a man necessarily by his own children. It's a little bit easier to judge him by his grandchildren. You can turn to Freud and he'll explain to you what I just said. And the Rev once said that in class, in a different context. He said it a little differently, but I knew just what it took me many decades. But believe me, I learned what he was saying. Sometimes your own students understand you better than your own family. Think about that quote. And that was the Rav. No, what? He's going to be angry at Yitzi. He's going to be angry at Moshe. He's going to be angry at Meir. He's going to be angry at this one, that one. They're not exactly clones of his. All right. I rest my case. Now, let me give you the source. I've said time and again the big three. The big three, when we speak about Rabbis Young, Goldstein, and Luchstein, the truth of the matter is that Rabbi Luchstein was a little younger than the other two. At a certain point, really, the big three were Rabbis Drachman, Young, and Luchstein. Later on, Rabbi Drachman, who was older, it's Rabbi Luchstein who takes over. But how do I know of this awe and reverence that the Rav had for them? Remember, Rakefet, are you making it up? I refer you to an interesting volume, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 2, page 238. Related by Rabbi Bernard Rosenzweig. I think that Jack knows that name. You've met him. It's Jack's wife's uncle. The Rabbinical Council of America, I give you the source here, Tradition, 1986. The Rev was still alive, but ill. And I'm quoting what Rabbi Beryl Rosenzweig wrote. The Rev once gave me a powerful insight into the changing character of orthodoxy. We were talking about my son and his grandson. You know who he means? Yitzi Lichtenstein, the Rosh Hashiva of Torah Vadas today. Because Yitzi stayed in America and spent a good few years with the Rav and a good few years in the YU environment. And he said to me, the Rav said to me, when you were a student at the yeshiva, who were your heroes? And he did not even wait for me to answer. He said, Rabbis Leo Young, Joseph Luchstein, Herbert Goldstein. And he said, tell me, who are the heroes of your son and my grandson? Certainly not their pupils. Their models are the Rosh Yeshiva, the people who represent learning and scholarship. End quote. That's a fabulous quote. That's the Rav. That's the big three. That's the rabbinate. Times have shifted. Times have changed. We don't have the rabbinate that we had 100 years ago, 50 years ago. It's a different world today. Who are the famous leaders? Who are the people you relate to? Agudat Yisrael, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. Who serves under Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah? All Rosh Yeshiva. One by one by one. Take the YU world. Who did the students relate to? Rabbi Heschel Schechter. Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, the son of Beryl, Jack's first cousin by marriage. Go one by one. The younger Rosh Yeshiva, up and coming, you'll see students, their eyes light up. I never yet heard a student tell me the name of the rabbi of Kehilat Jeshurun today, the rabbi of Jewish Center today, the rabbi of Westside Institutional today. The rabbis are tolerated, I'll put it that way. But the Rosh Yeshiva, revered. But we're dealing with 100 years ago. I want to quote another source. Remember what I said to you. Memoir literature is fabulous because you're no longer guessing. When we try to reconstruct the history of Torah, or any history for that matter, you take Napoleon Bonaparte. You know how many books have been written about Napoleon? Who was he? You can find books describe Napoleon as a gong. And you'll find books describing him as a Hitler in miniature. Right or wrong, Jack? You take Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. You can't believe the greatest mind, the one who won the war. You find other books, a drunken bum. And, all right, you're trying to recreate the past. It's not simple. I had a teacher in graduate school, Rabbi Professor Jacob Agis, a well-known name, and he stormed at the class. Not Jacob Agis. Jacob Agis was his brother. Correct me. That his brother was the Reconstructionist Rabbi, Irwin A. Agis. I think in Hebrew it was Avram Yitzchak, but in English it was Irwin A. Agis. Am I right or wrong? Help me out. And so I had Professor Agis, and he was famous for making sharp statements, which is something I always avoided because I saw what he did in class. That's the famous story where Reb Heschel, as a kid, Heschel ripped Kriya in class, and he threw him out of the class. So you don't know the story. You're all looking at me, or you know the story. So he made a comment, Professor Agis, that the Rambam, I can't repeat it. My mouth will not utter the words, but he, you know, the Rambam has certain chumras when it comes to sex. If you go into the Mor Nevuchim, the Mishkal, that there's no real words for sexual intercourse because it's degrading. It's the famous Rambam, and my Nachmanides takes issue with the Rambam and takes him to task. And also certain psukim of the Rambam, he was to machmir, and Professor Agis very sharply criticized the Rambam, and Heschel was 2 years after I had the same course, and we walked out of class, and Abba and I say to each other, boy, what an idiot he is, what a dummy, that's the way you talk about the Rambam. But notice, we walked out of class talking to each other, and we didn't rip Kriya. 2 years later, the whole yeshiva was shaking, because he repeated the same lecture every year. These people taught the same course every year. If you could rob their notes, they couldn't teach anymore. It was amazing how they would repeat the same course. 2 years later, we heard that a kid named Heschel Schachter stood up and ripped Kriya in class. You don't know, do you know that, Abba? And he threw him out. Heschel couldn't graduate college. He was missing one course, the Jewish history course. So finally, they made an arrangement. He could take a course in Bernard Rebbe Graduate School, and that Jewish history would count for the one he's missing from college. So he ripped Kriya. I said, Tommy, see the difference between us? We walked out and cursed to ourselves, and he got up and ripped Kriya. But what's amazing about responsible literature, Agis once made a statement, we can recreate all of Jewish history. So I raised my hand, I say, Professor Agis, we don't have a time machine. How can we recreate? We're only guessing. How can we go back 1,000 years ago? Responsible literature. That was Agis. All right, he's right. You can recreate a great deal through responsible literature. But still, there's so many loopholes. There were no newspapers then. Today, it's a lot easier, particularly with the internet. What you have on the internet, you can not only recreate history to a certain degree, you can relive it. You can go to a Fabringen of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I mean, it's unbelievable what we have today. But this was Agis. Shocking. But one thing I can tell you, memoir literature is fabulous. Why? Because it's real. You're not recreating. It's what the person really felt and thought. You don't like it, you disagree, others felt differently. That's true. But you have every right to say, quoting this person, this was the impression that was left upon this individual in the year so and so. I want to quote to you from another volume. Good volume. From Washington Avenue to Washington Street. Recognize the volume. Page 125. And I'm quoting from a little kid who studied in Yeshiva University. We're going back to the 50s. And here's what he has to say. As aspiring rabbis, we were also educated by New York's leading rabbinical figures in addition to the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rav acknowledged rabbis Leo Young, Joseph Flick, and Herbert Goldstein as the heroes of his students during the 40s and 50s, and I give you the source that I just quoted. The students alluded to them as the Big Three. And then I go on to describe Rabbi Young, One concept he expressed in class became a focal point of my own thinking. It was simple, but yet far-ranging. Dr. Young declared that his life experiences taught him that, quote, Judaism is perfect, Jews are not, end quote. I was the site of Sephorism endless times during the ensuing decades. And let me tell you, unfortunately, this little quote is as real and even more important today than it has ever been. Dove, you know what's going on in New York? You know what's going on in New Haven? No, you don't know. Okay. Ignorance is bliss. Colleague of mine whose picture appears in Rakafet Aron, Chelik Dalit. He's the easiest to identify out of the 29. Faces 80 years in jail at the age of 80. Sentencing will be in November. It's no secret. Danny Greer. Everyone's talking about it. I get sick. I can't even talk about it. I don't even want to discuss it any further. Someone I knew intimately from 1952 on. He was a year behind me in Yeshiva. Knew? Malka Leifa. You know what's going on here with Malka Leifa? Read the papers, hear the news, watch television, look at the websites. Send it to Australia. They're furious at the state of Israel. They don't extradite her. Sad, sad. We'll see what happens. Litzman, who was the most popular minister 2 years ago, every survey showed the American Gerach Chassid as the most popular minister in the state of Israel. No, he's going to be indicted shortly for what he did as minister of Briyut, health, whatever they call it in English, intervening to save her skin. Judaism is perfect. Jews are not. And let me tell you, Danny, when you marry and have children, you should inculcate your children from the age of 3 on with that understanding. I always tell my grandchildren, not that it always helps, I say, don't give me examples of the bad people. Look at the good. And then I go on to describe, 1 year we studied Rabbi Herbert Goldstein, homiletics and practical rabbinics, and the other year with Rabbi Joseph H. Lukstein, I described Rabbi Goldstein, despite his reputation as a singularly successful, creative, and charismatic rabbinical leader, Rabbi Goldstein related to us as our colleagues rather than as an elite professional. In other words, he related to us that we were his colleagues, not that he's looking down upon us. He understood our quests and aspirations. He taught us how to preach and stress clarity and consciousness. Watch this quote. If you cannot get the idea across in 12 minutes, do not get up to preach. And boy, it's the hell on the net. And Charlie, I look back on my life. One time I was an absolute dummy, fool, nut. I'm ashamed of myself. I was a young rabbi. It's 1962 in Maplewood, and I was dealing with kashrut problems in the greater Essex County area. I must have spoken for 35 minutes. Shabbos morning, the handful of people there just unrolled their blankets, took out their pillows, and went to sleep. Much better that when you finish, people should mob you and say, Rabbi, why didn't you go on? We could have listened to you. People already told me you could have gone on for hours. I always answer, yeah, you could sit there and enjoy, but where do I get the kayach to go on for hours? But it's very true. You're going to get up to preach, have a message, hit it home, don't dilly-dally, catch them with a good story, but as I've told many congregations, if I was the president here, I would install a podium that collapsed after the rabbi spoke for 18 minutes. Automatic. Ah, the Balabatim love it. And particularly when you get up to speak at Sudashli Shit, this always happens to me in Lawrence, and there's a tremendous crowd. They come from all over. So I always get up to say, my dear friends, you have nothing to worry about. I was once in the act of rabbinate, and it's a nisa d'oraita to keep the people a minute or two late from making havdalah. I'm watching the clock. Oh, then they relax. They're no longer tense. The rabbi will finish on time. But that's Rabbi Goldstein. And then I continue, and I talk about Rabbi Lookstein. And what can I tell you? Rabbi Lookstein, he was the character par excellence. As anyone who studied with him, he was very short. He was not... He could barely rise. They had to build a stand under the podium so he could stand up in it and you could see him. But when his mouth opened, wow, it was pearls and pearls of wisdom. In the classroom, Rabbi Lookstein regaled us with the description of his struggles in doing away with the cuspidors in Kehilat Jeshurun. I mean, that everyone quotes that. And it's true. And we used to sit there, Kehilat Jeshurun, you know, who davened there? When you davened there on a Shabbos morning, you were davening with billions and billions of dollars. And could you imagine the fights he had in the 1920s, the 1930s? You don't even remember a cuspidor. Do you know what a cuspidor? I remember it. In the shul, in back of the shul, it was a place where the water was on the floor like a urinal, but it wasn't for a urinal. You spat there. People would walk them back. One after another. You know, and this was a Zeo Mingaton in Europe, Zelda in the shuls in Europe, evidently. The cuspidor. And he fought. Some of the old timers insisted that this removal was a violation of traditional synagogue etiquette. Short in height, but tall in determination, Lookstein gradually guided KJ into a flagship synagogue of modern orthodoxy, possessed of a golden tongue. Lookstein was acknowledged as the leading orator of the Orthodox rabbinate. He sought to guide us so we would be capable of discharging our rabbinical functions and dignity. The wedding ceremony, the funeral oration, the weekly sermons were to be reflections of the new standards that the KJ rabbi pioneered on the modern scene. He also taught us the importance of well-crafted titles for our sermons that would attract interest. Among his own sermons were titles such as Clothes Makes the Man, A Religious Analysis of Freedom, and Between Washington and Lincoln. And here I have the story, which I've told many times. Years later, I heard of an incident that transpired towards the end of Rabbi Lookstein's life. A young yeshiva university, Rosh Yeshiva, was invited to deliver a lecture under the sponsorship of the synagogue's adult education program. Lookstein learned that there was a poor turnout for the event. He subsequently met the young scholar and inquired as to the title of his lecture. The Rosh Yeshiva, and it's Aaron Kahn that I'm talking about, responded that it was about the unique analytical method of Rav Chaim Brisker, which was utilized in contemporary Torah study, Talmudic study. Rabbi Lookstein instantly remarked, with such a title, it was not surprising that there was such a poor attendance. The Rosh Yeshiva asked what he should have headlined the lecture. Rabbi Lookstein immediately responded, motioning with his hands as if he was spelling out the title in the air, "There is more to Brisk than tea." Got it? The brisk tea, Lipton's tea, advertised over the world. These were the big three. I rest my case. This was the impact, the image, the vibrations, the vibes. I want to show you one more source of interest. I had a Talmud in, I think it was both in BMT and in the Kollel. He married a Talmid of mine from Michlala. He's very famous today. A professor at Bar Ilan, Adam Furziger. If anyone recognizes the name, I believe that Professor Fergus Furziger, I think he was a native of Riverdale in the Bronx. And he went to Ramaz. And he spent his doctorate and a lot of his research centers around modern orthodoxy, Ramaz, Rabbi Lookstein, YU, the modern orthodox world, sociologically and religiously, etc. Published a number of books. And this is quoting from an article that appeared in Religion and American Culture in 2012. It's volume 22, issue 1. Outside the shul, the American Soviet Jewry movement and the rise of solidarity orthodoxy. And he makes an interesting point here, which sociologically is probably true. 100 years ago, the contemporary American scene was mainly Reform rabbis, a handful of conservative. If the New York Times had to interview anyone, it inevitably was a Reform rabbi. Orthodoxy was viewed as a dying breed. You all know the famous march on Washington. By the Hebrew calendar, it's exactly today, 2 days before Yom Kippur, 1943. Figure out how many years ago it is. You're on to more than 75 years already, right or wrong? 76 years. Wow. Famous march. 200-300 rabbis, you read. People are trying to do research. Everyone asked me, where was the Rav in the picture? I tell them the Rav was a small-time rabbi then. People don't realize he was not born the Rav. Rav Moshe was not born Rav Moshe. It took a long time till they achieved their status. You're born, you're a kid, got to grow up, you have to struggle. But the greatest Rabbanim, there's Rav Lezer Zuber, there's Rav Leventhal, there's Rav Rosenberg, looking at who's leading the march, there's Rabbi Meskin, a little bit in. And Roosevelt refused to see them. His Jewish, the man who advised him on Jewish affairs told him, these are a sickly weed, they have no influence. They're part of yesteryear. It's not worth wasting the president's time. All right, that was a famous incident that plays very big in Mori Rebbe's life, the Boston Rebbe's life. To a certain degree, it's the catalyst that ultimately turns the greatest Agudah spokesman in the United States to the greatest religious Zionist of the 20th century. Kol Dovid Dofek has never been equaled. It is one of a kind. You meet Israelis, and I tell them I was in the audience when the Rav gave Kol Dovid Dofek, 1956, 8th anniversary of the State of Israel. They want to touch me. I'm like, I don't know, a saint, what would be the word? A relic, a holy relic that you were in the audience. So that might, but it's true. The Torah Jews played no role. But the Russian Jewry issue came along by the late 50s. Torah is on the map. Remember, in 1956, there's a guy named Rakefet. He's said 1,000 times over and published in 100 different ways, and we'll reach it in this very class room, maybe even this year. 56 is the turning point. The Cherem, the Iser, against mixed board of rabbis, synagogue council, reform, conservative. And then an issue came along where the greatest leadership, one after another, were Orthodox rabbis, Russian Jewry. Could you imagine earlier in life, where did Orthodox rabbis take public stands? Who was interested in what they had to say? Russian Jewry, here you have millions of Jews, and here we're sitting in this classroom. Is there anyone here who's not a direct descendant of Russian Jewry? Greater Russian Jewry? East European Jewry? Where do I come from? Where do you come from? Just think for a minute. And here, whoever survived World War II, we don't hear from them. They can't practice. And this became a cause for lepra. And I want to mention Meir Kahana again. It hurts me that the press here is so anti-Kahana. They are right. He had certain viewpoints that most of us don't agree with. But there was a lot of good to him. And I can tell you it was the mid-50s, and it probably was the first time Meir Kahana went public. Remember, they had a big Sputnik rally, and people were frightened of Russia. And he went public and started a demonstration. I remember after class, they asked the Rav, should we participate in these demonstrations? And I'll never forget the Rav's answer. Quote, word by word, what, we should make the same mistake we made against Hitler? And he absolutely felt participate. Later, that opinion was fine-tuned. I'll hope to write it up in a different context. Be'ezrat Hashem was fine-tuned. You have to check with the experts. But the idea of demonstrating, of yelling and shouting, the Rav was 100% in favor. And now you had a cause. And now you take the Rabbi Joseph Lichtenstein's son, who we spoke about, Hacky, Yecheskel, Haskell, whichever name you know him by. And I got to give Hacky a lot of credit. It's not easy to be the son of a world famous rabbi. I need not tell you, you can do a whole history of the type of children that resulted from great rabbanim and their marriages. Not always can we be proud. It's not easy. Not easy to live in your father's shadow. Not easy. And he succeeded his father, and he was not the speaker his father is, doesn't have his father's golden mouth, but he became a fabulous rabbi. And there's no one like him. What he could accomplish, the institutions he built, the fundraising, and his talks, his content. No one like him. You got to give him all the credit. His son, Joshua, my dear student, he already couldn't handle the rabbinate. All right, he went into chinuch. He's very successful today in chinuch. Kol hakavod to him. But you got to give Haskell all the credit. But Adam Furziger, in this excellent, excellent article, makes an interesting point. Until the Russian Jewry issue, Haskell lived in the shadow of his father. Who was he? Assistant Rabbi, KJ. Principal Ramaz. Assistant Principal Ramaz. Living in the shadow of his father. But when Hacky got involved with Russian Jewry, he was one of the, among the many rabbis involved, Rabbi David Miller's father, Rabbi Israel Miller, Rabbi Heschel Sach, the senior. You can go one by one. These were world-class people, world-famous Orthodox rabbis. Rabbi Haskell Lichtenstein, and it, quote, it was the turning point of my life. Just as it was a turning point in Haskell Lookstein's life that gave the young rabbi an outlet for self-expression outside the shul, the Soviet Jewry movement engendered a model for the relationship between Orthodox and non-observant Jews that could never exist within a synagogue framework. It's right. Orthodoxy was on the map. Orthodoxy led demonstrations. Birnbaum, YU, the student struggle for Soviet Jewry. What they did, the outreach, the national council, the local councils. You had Jews who were Mechallel Shabbos. But the rabbis, who did they look up to now? Who took the lead? Orthodox rabbis were now on the map. But there's one paragraph here, Danny, which is very, very fascinating. Beginning on page 104. As time went on, Lookstein, younger than Miller and Schachter, those are the two rabbis I just referred to, Rabbi Israel Miller and Rabbi Heschel Schachter, gradually adopted approaches identified with activist elements. He took Russian students to rallies at the Soviet mission and even chained himself to the wall, which led to his arrest by New York City police. This was certainly to the chagrin of his father, Rabbi Joseph Lookstein, who was an architect and pioneer of the, quote, church-like, end quote, approach to Orthodox synagogue culture, but was simultaneously a devotee of old Jewish politics. The elder Lookstein attained prominence in the interwar period and considered his son's public activism unbecoming a Jewish leader in America. And boy, that is an insightful point. Could you imagine Rabbi Lookstein, Kehillat Jeshurun, where when they took the Torah out, there was a whole procession, and you had to put on a high hat, what used to go on in these shuls. You couldn't come into Davin if you didn't have a jacket on. This was Rabbi Joseph Lookstein. I can tell you a story, I'll tell you the name. A very prominent doctor in New York, Rabbi Bernard Kabakow, K-A-B-A-K-O-W. Make believe you heard the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise. He was always written up as one of the 100 top doctors. This was an oncologist second to none. Bernie Kabakow. No, Bernie Kabakow became a Baal Tshuva. His kids went to Ramaz. I spent the Shabbat in his house. By the way, the phone never stops ringing. They're calling from all over the United States with the, what are the people who have cancer? They have to know. Chemotherapy. How to balance it out. A percentage of this, percentage of that. And all Shabbat, he's being called to the phone to give life-saving answers. So Bernie, davened in KJ, it was very hard for him because he loved Or HaChaim much better. He's not that formal. He couldn't take the formality. But he tells the story. One time Sunday morning, he's playing tennis early in the morning. They reserve a place on the court, and he's playing tennis with this multi-billionaire who he had helped and treated. And he says, come, you'll come, Davin. And they got the KJ. He's walking in, all right? Bernie Kabakow, Dr. Kabakow, and bringing in a guy who can unload $5 million like I unload 5 cents. I'll tell you why I'm saying 5 million later. And they threw them out. They didn't have jackets. They didn't have ties. Now it's different than KJ, Baruch Hashem. But could you picture, here is Rabbi Joe Lookstein, dignity par excellence, put on a suit of the Upper East Side on the old-fashioned orthodoxy, and here's his son being chained to the fence and being arrested by New York police. He established a new identity for himself. And by the way, with the chaining, Joe Lookstein is part of the world of Meir Kahana, part of the world of Steve Riskin. Charlie, who are we talking about? Who chained themselves to the fence? How many times were they arrested? My student, Dr. Norman Gold, boasts until today, he can tell you how many times he was arrested, and one time he was arrested and the police were harsh, and the very guy that was harsh to him, years later, Normie Gold is operating on his mouth. He was an oral surgeon, a top oral surgeon in the New York, in the New York area. And the guy remembered and he apologized. He felt quorum and he said every year he would send him a gift for what he did for his mouth and apologizing once again that he slammed him around when he threw him into the police van. And Normie Gold will always speak about whenever they were arrested, and there's Meir Kahana being arrested, that's the whole trip to the police station, Meir would talk and learn and give them Divrei Torah, give them Chizuk. He said it was worth getting arrested just to hear Meir's Divrei Torah. And I'll add a little bit more from the lore and legend of what we're touching upon. So, of course, Hagi became very well known in the Soviet movement, and he had on his shul, if any of you passed the shul, in the 80s, into the 70s, into the 80s, on the bulletin board, it would announce the times of davening, and it would tell you at the bottom, this is Sharansky's 212th Shabbat in prison, in exile, in Siberia. Every Shabbat, week after week after week, where Sharansky, Anatoly Sharansky, nothing Sharansky, where he is. By the way, his name today officially is Sharon, but it never caught on. Sometimes when you change your name, Steinsaltz changed it to what was it? Ibn Yisrael, I believe his name is. Steinsaltz. Ibn Yisrael. It should be Ibn Yisrael, I believe it's pronounced. But it never caught on. Rakef, it caught on, so no one knows my name is Roscoff. I told you the stories. They go to my brother, and they don't know that the doctor they're dealing with is my brother. But it's interesting with name change. But so now he's, Meir Kahana is in jail. He's now in halfway house. And where's the halfway house? On the Upper East Side. So Shabbat, he's now needs a place to eat. He's just been released to the halfway house. He's allowed to go out like Greer's allowed to go to jail, go out to shul. He's not in jail yet. There's an appeal. Although they may put him in jail, they're going to have to make a decision on the appeal, if they're going to let him stay out with the appeal, or because the guilty charges are so serious, he'll be in jail. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But he's in the halfway house, and he calls the Luxteins, could he come Friday night for supper? And of course, they say yes, and the Luxteins, Hacky and Audrey, told me the kids were shaking. By the way, three of his four children are my students as well. Rabbi, the Luxton children. So they're all from kids. You got to give credit, although not one lives in Israel, and that upsets me. I can tolerate people living in Lawrence and Woodmere and Flatbush, but they have to have some of their family here already. Once you have some, the rest will ultimately follow Be'ezrat Hashem. And the kids are all shaking. They figure Meir Kahana is coming, you know, with horns, with guns, with arrows. And he comes in, the nicest guy in the world, reserved, quiet, dignified, filled with Divrei Torah. And it was like an eye-opener for them that it's not the Meir Kahana of the New York Times. So this very fascinating. I just want to throw that in because Joe Luxteen, Rabbi Young was not Zeicha, Rabbi Goldstein was not Zeicha, but Rabbi Luxteen was Zeicha that his own son took over KJ and he continued to build it. Today KJ flourishes many, many minyanim on Shabbat, even a beginner's minyan that George Rohr leads. It's amazing what they have there. And his son developed his own identity mainly due to the Russian Jewry movement. And it's interesting, the contrast. Can you picture Joe Luxteen having to put up with the rabbi of his congregation, of his area, of the Upper East Side, chained to the fence and taken away in a police van, in a paddy van. Okay. My dear students, we have arrived. We covered the big three. We covered what's happening in the shul. I'm all right. Baruch Hashem, I hope we did a good job. But now we're coming to something much deeper. And I haven't seen this expressed as articulately as I will in the next number of weeks. But look at our Sunday class. We spent a good 2 months, 3 months, last year, this year, on the whole shaila of inviting people to shul, inviting people to your house, people who are driving on Shabbos. I have to tell you, I got an email, and they're going to bring it to me after Sukkot. They say some reason it's not online. Chabad, some Chabad publication, just came out with a major article on Morris Engelberg and Joe DiMaggio. And I can tell you, whoever did the article did not do his research, because they... If he did his research, he should have contacted me. I could have told him. There are not too many people alive who both shook hands with Joe DiMaggio and Morris Engelberg. But you're looking at one. I'm very anxious to see the article. Morris Engelberg is a classic example. I told you, this is the man. Joe DiMaggio died in his arms. Joe DiMaggio trusted him. Joe only trusted Jews. Whatever the reasons are, you'll see Jackie Gleason. It's interesting. Jackie Gleason also only trusted Jews. There are other examples, big personalities, Hollywood personalities, and they only trusted Jews. So we went to see Morris 20 years ago, let's say. When he went in to take a gift out of the vault for yours truly, I looked at all the diplomas, and there I see in the middle, remember I told you, with all the Narishkeit DiMaggio gift, this Catholic charity, that Catholic charity, this, that, the other, in the middle is a Hebrew diploma. I look at it, Morris Engelberg, graduate of Torat Chaim Yeshiva, Brooklyn. When Morris came out, you know, no one pays my salary. Hashem Zichnisht. I'm an outspoken guy at times. I say, Morris, how the heck did you become an Eisvaf like this on Mechallel Shabbos? You go to a conservative temple? Look where you were raised. And Morris says to me, I quote, Rabbi, you asked a good question. All I remember of yeshiva that the teachers, the rabbis beat me with rulers. End quote. Okay. When he says that, I can't say another word. Read Washington. I tell a different story, giving the same message happening right here in Yerushalayim, a few blocks from here. This episode I talk about in Washington took place. Kiryat Moshe. No. A year ago, I'm back in Florida. My student says we got to visit Morris again. All right, we go to visit Morris. And I come into the office. He's not a poor man. He's an estate lawyer. Anyone walking into his office, the sand starts to drop. Let's face it, it's $500 a half hour. But all right, the rabbi from Jerusalem. I take a look. There are cards announcing a shul. It's named after his father, the Beis Medrash. We come to meet. All he can talk about is the shul. He built it. Chabad got hold of him, a new Chabad shul. Once a month he sponsors a Sudat Leil Shabbat. His wife, his daughters, they all went along with him. But there's one fly in the ointment. He mentions to me, the cardiologist, I don't repeat everything, I trust you know what I'm talking about. The cardiologist who made the connection for us 20 years ago, Sashem Shabbos, in Israel of Hollywood, Florida. He can't come for it, he doesn't drive. So here you have an Orthodox shul, Chabad shul, a Friday night Suda, and people driving. Now, what did we speak about in class? Forget about it on a personal level. All right, someone who raised in Rebbe, unfortunately, my son left Yiddish time. I invite him Friday night. What can I do if he and his wife and my grandchildren don't come? I won't have any contact with them. All right, that's an interesting Shiloh. Remember, I quoted the Baruch Lichtenstein who quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. All right, we dealt with it. But forget about that. This is a shul. You have Atlanta, Georgia. You don't need a better example. The big Orthodox shul in Atlanta, Georgia that changed the face of Torah in Atlanta has a parking lot open in Shabbos. Stamford, Connecticut. The big, tremendous Orthodox shul. A parking lot open on Shabbos. Graduate of the Kollel is the Rav there, Danny Cohn. Should live and be well. Terrific rabbi. I was told there are Chabad places around the world that have parking lots open on Shabbos. What are we talking about? Are we from? Aren't we from? Tell me, was this question asked in Eastern Europe? Go back 150 years, gain siddiks and shtetl. Whoever heard of it, you're going to ask, what kind of question is that? They'd smack your face. What are you, an Amoritz, an Apikiris? An Oiswaf, a Maskil, a Tzioni? Whoever asked such questions? And yet, you know how much literature, if Raketic would spend months and he's only quoting the literature, you can spend half a year going through all that's been written on this topic. I just showed you yesterday that something just was published 2 weeks ago. Quoted it on this very topic. Yesterday and this year, that's how we began. But what do we see from all this? That in order to perpetuate Yiddishkeit in the Western world, we have to make compromises. And everything will boil down to the terrible question, what can we do, what can't we do? How can we take the rubber band and stretch it? If you overstretch it, it snaps, it breaks. What are the limits? This is a haunting question. And there's no black and white guidance because you didn't find these problems at the time of the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah, the Shachan, the Taz, the Magen Avram, and the Chelkat Mechokek and the Beit Shmuel. You didn't find these problems. Either you were religious or you left the fold. There are plenty of Mishubadim who left the fold, unfortunately. But in modern times, take the Israeli scene. Take the Israeli scene. You saw the advertisements? They're looking for Balei Tefillah, Baal Tokeya. They want to have services all over Israel. Tzoha. No? You saw the... Can anyone here blow shofar? Anyone volunteer? Have grandchildren. They're married already. Most of my grandchildren are married. They don't volunteer enough to be at home. They can't go to Uman and they can't volunteer for Tzoha. But they volunteered. No, what are you talking about? You go into communities, you set up a tent, you go door to door, you advertise. You get people who barely know how to daven. Barely know, all right, they can read Hebrew, they can read Bialik, they can read Achad Ha'am. So you have to make a condensed service. There's the atmosphere. It's so different, so difficult. You have a central Seder in the army. Chief of staff comes, he flies in, you know, much Chilul Yontif is involved. All right? One day we'll have a chief of staff who'll go with a yarmulke and sits outside and drays and be a different story. But these people don't know anything. Democracy. All right, there has to be a flavor of Judaism. How much can we compromise? How much can't we? And once you start compromising, where do you draw the line? There's no black and white answer. We've struggled with this problem for well over 100 years today. And now, at this moment in time, you have examples of rabbis, successful, proud to use the word Orthodox, Balabatim, who are proud to say they belong to an Orthodox synagogue. But just think, what is the conservative movement all about? And perhaps I'm making a mistake even to use the term conservative at this moment in the class. It didn't exist yet. How did the conservative movement begin? 1886. But really it began 1883. What happened in 1883? Do you remember? Yeah. Hebrew Union College had its first graduation. And they're celebrating. Reform movement now has a college. And they want to turn out American rabbis for all Americans. And they're going to have graduates. And they're going to have a dinner at Highland House in Cincinnati. And they invite all the rabbis from the East Coast. Many of them rabbis of large, prominent Orthodox synagogues, Spanish, Portuguese, Mikveh Yisrael, etc. And what do they serve? First course, shrimp cocktail. And people were petrified, astounded. And they realize that of this seminary, proper rabbis will not eventuate. And they started talking and planning, and in 1986 they organized Jewish Theological Seminary. You can read their preamble to their constitution, to their basic ground rules, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh, Hebrew language, the land of Israel, everything that the Reform don't believe in. And they began. And they always claimed they were an Orthodox institution. By 1902, they were falling apart. There was no need for their graduates. You had plenty of European rabbis who had come, emigrated to America. They can serve as the East Europeans. An American rabbi who can barely learn Gemara, that's a rabbi? Jacob Schiff got involved, brought in a fortune of money, and said we need, quote, I'm using his term, an enlightened orthodoxy in America. And he brought over Solomon Schechter, and Solomon Schechter, world famous Cairo Geniza. Schechter, his father was a Sheikhet. Shnur Zalman is his Hebrew name, tells you a stump from Chabad, his Chabad family. He put JTS on the map. And here are their graduates going out all over America, facing pressure from the congregants. Reform is all over the place. Americanization beckons. It's a new generation, a second, a third generation. They don't know Hebrew. Give us English. They can't understand why women are relegated behind the fence. Women can now smoke in public. Virginia Sims doesn't go to jail for smoking anymore. And these rabbis are also making compromises. And they say they're Orthodox. Well, are they Orthodox? Aren't they? What has happened in New York? The big three? Who is, who isn't? And Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up after Sukkos with Solomon Goldman. And a lot of new information has just surfaced in the last 10, 15 years on Solomon Goldman, the trial. And what you're going to see is epic making. It opens your eyes. And then you'll understand why I claim the big three forced the conservative movement to ultimately admit they are conservative with a capital C. Okay. To reiterate, what have we done today? We finished out the big three, we finished out Lichtenstein, we finished the relationship between the father and son, and we gave words of introduction to Solomon Goldman. We'll pick up exactly where we left off.
Who was the rabbi?
Excuse me?
Also did, who was the Rav in Great Depth?
Oh, the Rav, okay, I finished out last week. I shouldn't be misunderstood. Now, this is Vic Snow uncovered something. I don't know who we have to turn to. Why can't we get it here? The pop-up sukkah. Go online, go to YouTube. Vic, here it is. You won't believe what you will see. Be aware, a sefer just came out. Yishlach Shlashav. It's an unbelievable detailed sefer on the Shrashim of the Rambam in his introduction to Sefer HaMitzvah. Gabriel Chazut, you can find it online as well. It's unbelievable what is being published today. Morty, I got bad news for you. You were born before the proper time. Anyone here about Korei? This is an article in, it's not finished yet, dealing with the Trup and how you can interpret the Torah according to the Trup. It's by Dr. William Gvirtz, who's an expert in the field. The article will appear in Chakira. Here is something that no one knows exact details. Reb Yitzchak Kaduri, the Mekubel, left secret writings, predictions on Israel's social media, and he talks about a standoff between two Binyamins. And he tells you what's going to happen, and no one has revealed what he wrote about what's going to happen. The family keeps it a secret. Here is a very moving article by a very famous Jew, Mayor Yaakov Soloveitchik, on his visit to Brisk. It's fabulous. He just was in Brisk. They discovered bones there of Lo Aleinu, the Kedoshim, and he says Kaddish. It's very, very moving. Here we are in Chabad, how 18th Street got its name. The Rebbe, this businessman, Mechalel Shabbos, Yontif, everything, and how he totally turns around gradually, but gradually has a big clothing store, and now he's frum, and he wanted to call it Shmata, which means rag in Yiddish. And the Rebbe was not happy that clothes is mechubadik. He quotes the Gemara where you call your clothes your honor. I was initially puzzled by his answer, but when I asked Rabbi Label Groner, the rabbi's secretary, he explained, quote, the Rebbe wants you to turn rags into clothes, not clothes into rags. You don't call it shmata. Here's another Chabad. This is by Rav Yehuda Krinsky, a Rosh Chodesh message from one of the heads of Chabad today. Beautiful story of the Rebbe where he gives a bracha to a photographer with his aide, and then he realizes the aide is not Jewish, and he has the secretary contact the people that he trusts. He wasn't offended. He realizes it's not Hanu year, but a bracha for good life is always appropriate, and they're very, very moved by both the bracha and the Rebbe's menschlichkeit. Here's an article on the Rebbe. He's all smiles. Very forward-thinking when it came to climate change. And it shows the Vade Shemesh, how do you say that in English? I don't even know. Dud Shemesh, Dud Shemesh. Shows them that the Rebbe photoshopped on standing what we have in our roofs, which I have, and I bless the technology every day. It's fabulous. Here is an interesting piece that's anonymous. Any of you, unfortunately, I have dealt with this. Any of you have dealt with mental illness, bipolar, here's a story how the Rebbe dealt with it. And you'll see he's successful within the context of that human being who suffers, how he uses it positively. Here's a beautiful story of it. This just came out now. It's all over. I saw it in the press as well. A shofar that survived Auschwitz. And you got to read the story, how it was blown and hidden, and it's been blown again today. This is on driving. Evidently, they heard Rakefet Shir about demonstrating against cars. Why do we waste our time demonstrating against computers? Cars kill millions. And here they called the cars death machines, and they claim, it's an op-ed piece in the New York Times, that self-driving tech won't change it. That even with the self-driving, which they're now beginning in Israel, experimenting in Tel Aviv, people will be killed. All right, we'll see. As you know, Yom Kippur is the anniversary of that terrible period here, the Yom Kippur War. Any one of us who lived it, I can remember that day. I can tell you exactly. I remember walking to Shua, walking to Rehov HaBavanel, where BMT davened. That was BMT, Rehov HaBavanel 24. So I remember crossing the street at Aza, Pinat Ari, Matudela. I see a lady who looked from to me driving a car, turning left. And I couldn't know. Left an impression, Yom Kippur morning. Turned out she was one of the head nurses at Hadassah, and she was driving to Hadassah. They had, you know, already alerted everyone. Then I remember hearing planes overhead. Then we finished Musaf, and an English kid living across the street, Babanel, ran in hysterical, we're at war. And 1 minute later, sound trucks were going up and down the streets telling everyone to turn on their radios. And everyone was being called up, and two of our madrichim never came back. Hashem Yirachem. And a nice article on Rabbi Beckerman, who fought in the war, and the Rebbe, and he's in Sinai. He was gone 6 months, and how he built the sukkah, and the lulav and etrog, and then the tefillin. He was an officer. Every spare moment when he would come to a new base, they would say, the tefillin man is here, the tefillin man is here. This is on the Sfadik Bika Cholim Hospital. I downloaded it from the Wikipedia. That's where Rabbi Maimon was rabbi in Seattle. Very, very fascinating. And finally, I'll reveal the secret why I said $5 million. A Long Island family where I taught, members of this family, Glaubach, just donated $5 million to NCSY, National Council Synagogue Youth. So Torah is on the map. Ashrenu Shezachinu, we should be zaita to a wonderful Yom Kippur. The weather seems to be with us this year. Those of us who have lived here many years can recall Yom Kippur when it was 37 degrees. People were fainting on the street. And at my age, I don't budge on Yom Kippur. Just daven, fall into my daughter's house, a bed, take a nap, back for mincha. Before you know it, we're making Haftalah. And it should be a Haftalah with the Gemach HaTim HaTovah L'Shnat Chayim Shalom Osha V'Osha V'Kolt of Salah V'Sora Tovet Bayit HaGuf Nahorim Ha'Aliyah Aleinu V'Al Kol Yisrael. After that, a very happy Sukkot. And we'll meet again right after Sukkot, the week after. It's normal. You see, it's the first time we can meet. Back to Bezrat Hashem normalcy, both with Las Vegas and with Solomon Goldman. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. Okay, Jack, any comments?